culture shock. It happens sometimes when we're in a place that's completely foreign to us. For Abigail Washburn, that place was China. She went there for 7 weeks as a freshman in college.
And I didn't really like it. Super polluted. I felt sick the whole time. I'd leave my dorm room and someone would have gone through my stuff, you know, from the security bureau. And I just had trouble connecting with anyone. I couldn't speak Chinese, and anyone who tried to speak English with me, it felt like they were practicing English or they were trying to sell me something. I came back to the States and I felt pretty disenchanted.
But one day, back in the U.S., Abigail had an epiphany. She describes it like this. She had a poster of Gandhi on her wall.
And so I woke up one morning and Gandhi was looking at me, you know. I looked at him and I was like, yeah, I know. And I realized I was disenchanted with 1.3 billion people on the face of the planet and I had to do something about it.
So she decided to go back.
And luckily, that second time I went back, I went to Sichuan province. I was just sitting on the dorm steps and an old lady walked by and a handkerchief dropped out of her back pocket. And I picked it up for her and I said, ni hao, ni hao. That's about all I could say. And she turned around and she looked at me and she had the cutest little silver bob, kind of cataract eyes. And she said, oh, thank you so much for my handkerchief. And she said, I've been teaching Chinese to foreigners for 50 years and I will teach you. Come to my house and I'll make you dumplings. I fell so deeply in love with her. And I knew from that time forward that I had to figure out how to share that kind of beauty that I felt in China with people in America. And what do you know, when I got back to the States, I called one of my relatives and they said, how is Japan?
Today, I'm talking to three people who are interpreters. They live at the intersection of different cultures and languages, and sometimes they're the only one in the room who can make communication happen. And that often means they spend time in places where they're not completely understood or they don't really fit in. Their work gets complicated really quickly. Abigail Washburn is a Grammy Award-winning banjo player who writes and performs in Mandarin and English.
I did get those questions in the beginning, like, who are you to be writing songs in Chinese? Look at you.
Scott Baker is a minister and an American Sign Language interpreter. His specialty is performances, like Shakespeare plays.
You very quickly run into the realities of interpreting poetry and interpreting art, which is that there is no such thing.
And David Morales is a Spanish-English interpreter. He grew up in Mexico to parents of both cultures, and he now works for people in fairly intense situations, like doctor's offices and courtrooms.
You have to convey the meaning exactly as it is. Whatever you interpret can give the person a leg up or a leg down.
From Nashville Public Radio, this is Movers and Thinkers, where I get to put three of the most interesting people in the city in one room and have a conversation. I'm your host, Emily Seiner, and I talk to these three interpreters in front of a live audience.
This episode of Movers and Thinkers is sponsored by Nashville Elf, a reclining bike with a solar-powered motor encased in a colorful egg-shaped pod. It's the future of urban mobility. Sign up for a test drive at nashvilleelf.com. Then lean back and let the sun help you pedal. And by the Jennings A. Jones College of Business at Middle Tennessee State University. It graduates creative entrepreneurs who change their communities for the better. Working professionals can get an MBA in 12 months, in person or online, with specialties in music business and healthcare management. Visit mtsu.edu/mba.
So for Abigail, what allowed her to really immerse herself in Chinese language was this love she found for someone in that culture. And for Scott Baker, it was kind of the same thing.
I tell everyone when they ask, because everybody always wants to know, how did you start, you know, being a sign language interpreter? There was a pretty deaf girl in my high school. There's nothing noble about it. But I come from a long line of interpreters. I'm the first one in my family in sign language. But my dad was raised in Nazareth in the 50s and 60s. Arabic's his first language. Hebrew and English kind of after that. My grandfather was stationed in Germany for a long time, World War II, spoke German, then learned Arabic. My aunt and uncle and cousins all speak Mandarin and Cantonese. So I've had interpreting modeled for me and intercultural exchange modeled for me all my life. And interacting between hearing culture and deaf culture has a lot of similarities and a lot of really distinct differences. I'm not deaf. And that is a barrier that exists that I will never cross over, and I can't even pause and consider, well, I'm kind of deaf. I'm not, and I won't be. And there is a divide there.
Unlike Scott and Abigail, David Morales learned both of his languages, English and Spanish, as a child when he was growing up in Mexico.
David, you describe yourself, I think, as fully bilingual and bicultural.
Well, I'm lying a bit there. It's I am fully bilingual. That is a fact. But I will always say that although I learn both languages at the same time, my mother tongue is Spanish. I've always, and I will always speak better Spanish. Now, the issue of bicultural, you never become fully bicultural. You have a dominant culture, it's the one you grew up in. That stays for you, that forms you, and that is the basis for your thoughts when you become an adult. I've always been straddling both cultures. My mom was American, or from the United States. I am a Mexican, but I am what they call a passer, right? I pass as an American.
Do you feel more comfortable in a Mexican setting versus an American setting, or do you feel like you're always sort of not fully immersed in either?
Well, I'm definitely more comfortable when I'm with Mexican nationals or Latinos in general, Spanish speakers. I'm more comfortable, but then again, I've always been this weird guy that never fits in quite into all places.
I wondered about this for Abigail. She's not of Asian descent. She's white. But at this point, she spent a lot of time in China.
Abigail, do you strive to be seen as Chinese, or is that something that you also, like, know that you...
No, I was just thinking about that because you're talking about that barrier. And this has been, it was a real thing for me to overcome at the beginning because you go to China and you look like me, you'll never be Chinese. You will never, ever, ever, ever be Chinese as hard as you try. Come to America, I walk around the street, I never think about who's American and who's not. It's so different. Any of my Chinese friends could come to America and become American. And when I went to China and realized that their nationhood did not include bringing foreigners in and making them their own, I felt rejected for quite some time.
Did you try at one point?
I did have a hope in my heart that if I could speak good enough Chinese, maybe I'd marry a Chinese man, maybe all these things, and I could be the closest thing. But as time has gone on and as it has been proven to me as I've watched the way Chinese nationalism has gone, I'm more and more unlikely to become Chinese at the moment. So I'll just wait. Maybe I'll be Chinese at the end before I go.
I have a similar, we all sort of have been bounced in and out of different cultures. It can be difficult at times, you know, that there are differences, intercultural differences that won't be bridged, that are tough to bridge. That's my job. That's what our jobs are, is to try to, you know, kind of hang out on those margins, try to hang out on the in-between and allow for the exchange and allow for the crossover. So it's not hard in the sense of I really wish, you know, that it were otherwise. That's not quite the way that it works in life in general. I wish communicating were easier, but you know, that's as much for a guy that I work with as it is for someone who speaks a different language.
Allowing for the exchange. For Scott, that often means helping deaf people understand what's going on at a hearing performance. For David, that means facilitating a conversation between two people who don't speak the same language. But for Abigail, it's a little different. Her job as a musician often involves creating something completely new that merges the two musical styles, like playing a traditional Chinese song on a banjo, or in this case, putting a whole new twist on it.
One night I was just reading Chinese poetry, as you do, and I read a poem by a guy named Meng Jiao from the 9th century, and he wrote this poem called Song of the Traveling Sun, and it's about a mother who's sitting knitting something. There's a thread in her hand, and she's knitting something, and it's for her. And it's for her son, who's traveling, most likely off to build the Great Wall. She doesn't know if she'll ever see him again. And she was expressing her love, her deep love, and deep grief, potentially, for never seeing her son again. I thought how beautiful it was, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then it hit me. Suddenly, I was making noodles in the kitchen, and I thought, what would it be if it wasn't Yodzian, Song of the Traveling Son, but it was Yonyin, Song of the Traveling Daughter? What would that sound like? And then words just started coming to me. 门外有个世界，心中有个声音，四方等你来呀，有女，有女。 And that means outside your door, the world is waiting. Inside your heart, a voice is calling. The four corners of the world are watching you, so you better go get it, girl. Travel, daughter, travel.
When you're in China performing traditional Chinese music or your own take on Chinese music, do you get resistance about that?
In general, I would say my original music in Chinese up to this point, the newness of my creations aren't exciting. In fact, in general in China, I would say history has proven itself. The ancient arts are incredible. Why do you need to introduce this new stuff, you know?
Do you ever feel hesitation about singing something or changing something because it's not your culture?
Oh, I've had to get really comfortable with the idea that people in America and China think I'm really weird. Really, I did have to at some point just say, it's okay, you know? But I also try to keep my wits about me and be practical about what does have an impact and what will bring about some kind of thoughtful, transformative bond between the two countries.
Could I interject?
This is David jumping in.
I would like to ask you, my tradition of music, what I have grown to love is the Caribbean music, what we know here as salsa, throughout Latin America. They just take anything that comes in. All the Latin rhythms that we know have this mixture of African rhythms and sounds and instruments combined with European things. And they've always been open about it. But here we have this, there seems to be a lot of resistance among certain groups, and they call it cultural appropriation, and there's an objection to that. Do you feel that that happens with what you are doing?
Yeah. I mean, not anymore. But I think that's because I found my identity as an artist more. But I did get those questions in the beginning, like, who are you to be writing songs in Chinese? Look at you.
And from whom?
Oh, some interviewers and some people that would come talk to me after the shows. But I've noticed in life that if you continue to do something with a full heart and good intention, that those kinds of things just go by the wayside, and in general, you can attract the people who think what you're doing is special, and that's been very heartening.
Coming up, David talks about how to establish trust as an interpreter in tense situations, Abigail explains why she likes playing Chinese songs in America, and Scott dissects his favorite Shakespeare scene, which also happens to be very difficult to translate. Stay with us.
This episode of Movers and Thinkers is brought to you by Nashville Elf. It looks like an Easter egg on three wheels, but really, it's a speedy reclining bike powered by a solar battery. I take the Elf out to a park, and a big family comes up, really intrigued.
Mommy, can we get it? Can we get one?
The mom, named Megan, takes the Elf for a test drive.
Woo! She's out of here. Look how fast that thing goes.
It turns out Megan has epilepsy and can't drive a car, but she can drive an Elf.
Like, if I could have that, wow, that would do for my life. And it's just cool.
Nashville Elf. It gets you moving, protects the environment, and could even change a life. Sign up for a test drive at nashvilleelf.com. This episode is also sponsored by the Jennings A. Jones College of Business at Middle Tennessee State University. To learn about what makes a great business school, I went to a surprising place, a brunch at Stephanie Pruitt's house.
Make yourself at home. There are egg casseroles, pancakes are in the works, water, coffee right there, mimosas on the back.
Pruitt's brunches are a place where artists can network with business people. Pruitt is both, because in her Jones College marketing classes, she learned that it's possible to make art and still make a living.
And that has made all the difference in me being a working artist and a poet who will also be able to send her own daughter to college because of my poetry.
You can get a business degree, online or in person, in as little as 12 months with the Flex MBA program from the Jones College of Business. Go to mtsu.edu/MBA.
You're listening to Movers and Thinkers from Nashville Public Radio. I'm Emily Seiner, and I'm talking to Scott Baker, David Morales, and Abigail Washburn about interpreting between languages and cultures. And they all run into this problem. Some things you just can't interpret. Take Scott. He's one of the ASL interpreters for the Nashville Shakespeare Festival. He's on the side signing during the plays.
You very quickly run into the realities of interpreting poetry and interpreting art, which is that there is no such thing. The job is to do our best in conveying meaning. One of my favorite mind benders was I interpreted the Nashville Shakespeare Festival production of Henry V, and there is a scene, frankly, the best scene in the play, is entirely in French. But it was a series of puns between two French speakers trying to learn English. So I was interpreting two French speakers badly speaking French about English puns into American Sign Language. What is that? You know?
So how did you deal with that?
Well, how does the audience member who doesn't speak French experience that? And they experience it visually, the way the actors communicate. And two ladies snickering over the way that words in English sound like dirty words in French is funny no matter what language you speak. So the idea is to give as close of an interpretation of the action that's going on. So the audience is watching what's going on behind me as the interpreter. I'm not the show, that's the show. They're watching that and looking to me to help them understand what's actually happening.
In other words, it's an art, kind of like the performance itself. And David says his line of work is similar.
Translators and interpreters do not translate or interpret words, they interpret meaning.
But there's also much more at stake when you're interpreting in a legal situation.
If you are in a judicial setting, if you are in a courtroom, you cannot add or subtract absolutely anything. You have to convey the meaning exactly as it is. Whatever you interpret can give the person a leg up or a leg down in a very serious situation. So the rules of ethics is not getting involved. But the people you are interpreting for, they have to trust you. And the judicial setting is very complicated because you're not allowed to have any contact with the people before or after, only during the procedure, whatever it is. So you cannot have a conversation in the hallway. All that is prohibited. So the only way they can trust you is the moment when you're doing the work for them, and all you have to do is do it the best you can, and they'll figure out that you are doing it right. There is a way of knowing intuitively when somebody is interpreting correctly. Even if you don't know the other language, you notice something doesn't look right.
And then there's this very straightforward issue of running into words you just don't know. For David, this happened when he was interpreting at a conference about bovine ticks.
It's an issue. The United States and Mexico share a huge border. Cattle cross the border, and there's this issue of certain infections that these animals have. Serious enough to have its own conference, right? So those things can be very tricky. I was actually, during that conference, I was suddenly talking about some other thing that was completely unrelated and they had not told me about. Very technical, very scientific. And what do? You just reach in and try to find, you know, all that scientific knowledge that you kind of learned and scribble words and ask for somebody to help you find the translation.
The bovine tick conference made me think about a DOD conference that I had to do.
DOD is an acronym for Department of Defense.
I mean, if you've ever talked to these people at the conferences, every fourth word out of his mouth was an acronym. And the speaker starts, and my eyes are getting big as I'm hearing these things, and I'm about 20 seconds behind what he's saying and giving it. And I looked at the client, and I said, I hope you know all of the acronyms. And he was like, yeah, I got all the acronyms. And I was like, good, I'm just going to give them to you. So that was one of the few examples where I had no idea what I was saying, and I was still saying it correctly.
Right.
And it was understood.
That's interesting.
Even though it was, there was no, you know, sort of understanding as it was on its way through.
Can I ask? Yeah, I've just been sitting here wondering how, I don't know if the ambiguity is the right word, the ambiguity, fluidity, potential meanings, the difficulty of translating. How has that affected your spirituality as a minister?
Oh, come on. My ordination prep is in the Presbyterian Church, so it's in American Protestantism. It is hard to have some of the views that we tend to have in American Protestantism, which again is my tradition, but it is hard to hold those as being lockbox eternal, you know, truths once you understand the way that language works. American Protestantism of the past 150 years has been enamored with ideas of verbal plenary inspiration and literal truth of Scripture. And the more you study the way language works, the way words work, what a word is, the more those ideas are just utter nonsense in terms of actually being able to communicate something true, something useful as a minister about what God has to say to his people.
Scott says, take the book of Psalms in the Bible.
We tend to think in the Western world, in the English-speaking world, about the King James translation of the Psalms. The language is so poetic. The language is so wonderful. It wasn't written in English. So it has those interesting poetic values, but it actually, the text actually has its own poetic values in Hebrew. We've had to assign sort of parallel poetic values in order to experience the beauty of it. But it's not actually translating that experience, and it's certainly not word for word.
I'm wondering, Abigail, do you have any songs that you play for Chinese audiences that seem to really resonate, even though they may not understand the language?
Not as much as the songs in Chinese, traditional songs. Those are the ones that really resonate.
What about songs in Chinese that resonate with American audiences?
Oh, I would say in general, American audiences that I play for, now that I've been doing this for almost 15 years, there's a following that is based on what I've been building as an artist, which is exciting. So I can do a lot with them and have them go for the ride. In front of audiences that don't know me as well, then they can, you know, I'll bust into something Chinese that's, and all of a sudden, oh, my banjo just sang with me. And all of a sudden, people will get excited, you know, and they'll be like, wow, that really does sound pretty good. And it surprises them, you know, because maybe they've never heard Chinese music before. But all of a sudden, for some people, it will resonate and they'll start to think about some Chinese things. They might even come up to me and talk to me and say, oh, I have a neighbor down the street who adopted a little Chinese girl. I'm going to have to bring them your music. Or when I was a little girl, there was a missionary that, you know, had lived in China and brought me back these little trinkets. Or just all of a sudden, these associations with China. And so what that says to me is every time I get to share this music, whether it sounds foreign, it sounds familiar, comfortable, uncomfortable, it creates closeness. Because in the minds of a lot of those people, they'll start finding associations with China that they wouldn't have been thinking of, you know, 4 minutes prior before I had sung that song. And so I see it as an incredibly powerful tool.
Well, David, Scott, Abigail, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's Abigail Washburn, Scott Baker, and David Morales. Movers and Thinkers is only possible because of Carl Peterson, Cameron Adkins, Mac Linebaugh, Anita Bug, Kim Green, and anyone who comes to the live tapings. You make the magic happen. Get on our mailing list and keep up with the show at WPLN.org/movers. And while you're at it, listen to the latest episode of our podcast, Neighbors, about a man who works as a barber in the same community where he once was a big-time drug dealer.
I remember going to church one day, and a thought arose in my mind that God wanted me to put the drugs that I was selling on the altar.
That's Neighbors on iTunes, Google Play, or anywhere where you listen to podcasts. Music for Movers and Thinkers is by Blue Dot Sessions and by David Coleman and Justin Shipper. I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville Public Radio.